We did it.
Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Ian Graham Leask is talking with Larry Watson about his latest novel, The Lives of Eddie Pritchard. Triumphant, engaging, and perceptive, Watson's novel examines a woman both aware of her power and constrained by it, and probes the way perception of someone in a small town can shape a life through the decades. Watson is the critically acclaimed author of 10 novels, including Let Him Go, that was recently adapted into a film starring Diane Lane and Kevin Costner.
And I'm Liz Olds. In the last part of the show, Josh talks with astrobiologist Caleb Scharf about his work, The Ascent of Information. Scharf argues that information is truly alive. All true data we create, all our emails, tweets, selfies, AI-generated texts, funny cat videos, amounts to a life form that has its own goals, needs, and can influence our well-being. Caleb Scharf is the award-winning author of The Zoomable Universe, The Copernicus Complex, and Gravity's Engines, and the director of the Columbia Astrobiology Center. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Larry, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Larry. Welcome back to Ride on Radio.
Thank you.
So you had a little passage you were going to read for us.
I'm going to read a little something from the very first section. The Lives of Eddie Pritchard is a novel in three parts, and it looks at Eddie at 20-year intervals when she's 24, 44, and 64. And in this section, as the story opens, Eddie is married to Dean Linderman, but she is traveling with his twin brother, Roy. They're going to a small Montana town to buy a truck and transport it back to their town. So here they are in the car together. Eddie slips off her flimsy rubber sandals and hooks her toes up on the lip of the dashboard. Roy turns his head toward her and with his finger slowly traces in the air the length of Edie's bare leg. "Tell me something," he says. "How do you get so tan working in the bank all day?" Edie quickly lowers both feet to the floor. She says, "We've got a folding chair we set up behind the building. During breaks and lunch hour, I sit back there. And I'm out on weekends, of course." "I wouldn't think you'd get much sun in that alley." Roy pinches his cigarette between his lips and extends both arms. "Me, I'm like a steak cooked on just one side." The car floats over the center line, and Edie starts to reach for the steering wheel. But then Roy takes hold of it once again. "About the only time I get out of the store," he says. "It's in the car, and then one arm hangs out the window, and the other doesn't get any sun at all." The only other car visible on this stretch of highway is at least a couple miles ahead, and then it vanishes, curving its way into the first of a series of low hills, each stitched to the next with a narrow, dark strip of cottonwood or bur oak. "Now you," Roy says, "you probably have to hike your skirt up plenty high to get so much sun." He leans forward to look at her and maybe undo a button or two. She doesn't say anything. "Of course, with those mini skirts you've taken to wearing. Oh, for God's sake, Roy, can't we have a normal conversation?" Roy smiles the smile of a man confident of its power to heal or beguile. "Why, sure, Edie. What did you want to talk about?" But she says nothing and turns her head away from her brother-in-law. She knows women whose husbands would never let their wives get into a car with Roy Linderman. But not Dean. No, not Dean.
Well, pretty good stuff. That's actually a good choice, because that's exactly the kind of conversation I want to talk about with you. Let me just reiterate a little bit of your bio. You were raised in Bismarck, North Dakota, and as Josh told our listeners, there's 10 acclaimed novels, including the Montana 1948. You've been on this show, I think, for several of those novels, mostly with me talking to you about them, and I think some others. And then there's this film adaptation of Let Him Go with Kevin Costner and Diane Lane, and that was just been released. So I'm interested to talk to you a little bit about that, how that's affected you at the end of the discussion about Edie. But I gotta tell you that this novel, it's just coming at a time for me reading it when I'm working on a lot of material as a publisher about how men affect women. And I thought this was the most extraordinarily sensitive work of you showing us how male behavior, especially male behavior on women, especially attractive women, is so destructive. And taking away all of their ambition and pushing them into various kinds of corners where they can't be themselves. And Roy Linderman is the character in this book that you've just introduced. You introduced him doing that. I mean, she's an object. He's looking at her legs, although he clearly, all the way through the book, does love her. And his destructive behavior towards it probably isn't intentional. But my goodness, you it's almost like a treatise that you produced here. Was that, I presume that was intentional.
Some of what you're talking about took me totally by surprise. I don't think, I agree with you absolutely about male behavior, that men do those things. Is it worse or not quite as bad that for the most part, men do not do those things consciously.
And I think you show that very clearly.
I think it must be a way of, it must be a way of we must be terribly insecure or something, and that we're trying always to exercise some power by diminishing others. And in the case of this novel and in the case of lots of people's lives, diminishing women.
As a guy
failing to recognize them in their full humanity.
Yeah, the book caught me. It really caught me right where it hurts. You know, I've got two daughters and three granddaughters, and you know, I've always loved women all my life. I don't think I've ever been an abuser, but I bet you when I was young, I did exactly what Roy Lindemann did, you know, to women. I don't really remember it, but I can just imagine it. It's so typical, the kind of smarmy, stupid behavior when you're, you know, literally trying to impress somebody in a way. And and what's remarkable about the book, you know, you've, as you said in your little introduction, you run the book through these three time zones with her in her 20s, her 40s, and her 60s, and it never stops. The behavior never really stops at all. And then it's, you see it passed on to her daughter and her granddaughter. So where's that coming from in you? That's very insightful. And have you got some women helping you with this and giving you some coaching about how they feel about these kinds of things? Give me the genesis of how this thing came about, because it's really, really hitting the spot.
Before I began this book, I thought this would be I thought Roy and Dean, it would be Roy and Dean Linderman's story primarily about these twin brothers who were in love with the same woman. And of course, twins offer all sorts of possibilities of issues of identity. And that didn't go away. But what turned out to happen in the novel is that the identity that comes into question is Edie's, and it's not her sense of self, but it's how other people see her, and impose an identity upon her that is useful to them, not to her. So she just sort of came to the fore early on in the novel, I just stayed with it.
Yeah, well, there's a section in the third section where she's in her 60s and people are talking about remembering her, and they remember her as they want to remember her, and she remarks upon this that's not her. It's not how she remembers herself. And I just sat back and contemplated that quite a bit and just thought, you know, I wonder how I do that. And I have people that, you know, from back where I grew up, still kind of remember me, and they tell me things that I did. I don't even remember some of those things. And I'm sure we all have to deal with some of that. And I guess it's frustrating. And, you know, how much does it change you if you are a woman that's already been altered partly by your beauty? You got lucky enough to be beauty, but the beauty itself is a double-edged sword. And your character Edie here. Go ahead.
Yes, when they are seeing her beauty, they are blind to other attributes that she has, her intelligence, her courage, her self-sufficiency. You know, I don't want to make it out as though to be beautiful is a hardship. I think we all know that beautiful people often have certain advantages in life. But you're exactly right. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Yes, it's difficult to be seen as yourself when the surface is so lovely.
Yeah, they see past the humanity, and there's this want that's in it. It's interesting, you know, to jump to the third section here, and she's a dental receptionist, which is very really well done. Very interesting dentist, by the way. We won't go into her, but that was quite a character you created here. I don't know if I'd have her work on my teeth, but there's a gentleman that walks by the dentist's office repeatedly, and he can't bring himself to come in and ask her out. And she doesn't want that.
He's an elderly fellow, but his behavior is what a 15, 16, 17-year-old boy would do.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a curious kind of almost stalking, and yet it's there's something pathetic about it too, and Edie finally confronts him.
Yeah, yeah.
And
It's wonderful.
Your teeth are fine.
Yeah, that's right. She says he wants to come in for a new cleaning and the tooth are fine, stay away. But, I mean, I think that really hit the nail on the head for me with the whole book, that scene. And of course, we're not going to give away the ending at all, but that's as far as we'll go, you know, into the delving deep into the book. But it's because it's not massively part of the plot as it moves forward. But what's so interesting about it is that you see certain kinds of males, even people who are very strong and have had good careers, not really growing up in this particular area. And kind of almost staying childlike. Not that women don't do that too, but the whole point here is that this is a particularly attractive woman that tends to hold her attractiveness. She's got good genes and she still looks very attractive at age 64 or whatever she is. And, you know, there's this elderly chap walking by. And what does elderly mean? You know, what do we mean by that these days? And, you know, you kind of ask those questions too. And, of course, in the third part, she hooks up again with Roy Lindemann. So do you want... Let's shift off Edie for a moment and talk about the Lindemann twins. Where did they come from in your thinking?
Well, partly from my family background. We just have an awful lot of twins on my mother's side of the family. My mother was a twin, and an uncle are twins. I have a nephew and a niece and great-grandparent twins. And I've always been fascinated that none of them are identical twins, but it's not necessary for them to be identical twins for them to be confused. I mean, I think back on the twins that I grew up with, and I know that sometimes people couldn't tell them apart, and some people could. So I thought they would be at the heart of the novel, and as I said earlier, I thought the question of identity and how she might see something in one of the men and that something might be absent in the other. And that's true, but it's not as though she finds something particularly appealing in one and its absence bothers her in the other. They're quite different men. Part of what interested me is that Dean, her husband, who is a good man, for some reason recedes purposely. And she says at one point, she's been in the company of Roy in a perfectly innocent way, and Dean was supposed to show up, but he didn't. And she, the next time she sees him, she confronts him and she says, "Are you trying to push me onto your brother? Do you want me to be with him?" And it's I can't say I begin to understand it myself, but it does seem something that's in those two men. And of course, Roy he's glib. He's a salesman, both by occupation and by character. And Dean is shy and withdrawn. He's quiet. Dean is the sort of person, I think, who has always been secure and worried that his wife is attracted to somebody like Roy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, whoa, wait a minute. Not like Roy, but Roy.
Yeah.
And she's not.
No, she's not. She's very faithful. And she's a wonderful character in that way. And people miss that of her and try to pull her off center with that kind of thing. But, you know, to stay a little bit with Dean, Roy Lindemann's brother, his twin brother, he's sort of trying to be the good guy. He's trying to sort of stand back and not be this glib, stupid, thoughtless infant that kind of wants something and just grabs for it. He tries to respect her, but he's held back. And I think a lot of men that try to behave correctly, especially with younger women, who don't really understand what's going on don't understand that, because there's still a part of them that wants to be pursued and wants to be chased. And she has a little of that going on. And she has to learn about it through her life and learn that that there are good men, you know. And then you kill him. And you kill him off. So tell me about that. How do you choose, when you've got good characters going on, how do you choose to murder them as an author?
Well, it wasn't.
I'm only kidding.
Is this sort of variation on kill your darlings?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Kill off your most likable characters or something. Time passed. Their marriage dissolved and decades passed and things changed, and they really changed for Dean. He had cancer but before he dies, he would like to see Edie one more time. Unfortunately, that message is not conveyed to Edie by Dean, but by Roy. And we know that Roy wants to see Edie again as well.
Yeah. So how do you, as a creative writer, forming character and forming plot and developing subplot, which you do a lot, we haven't even touched on that, probably won't get time for it, but, what made you choose to pull Dean out of the text and to leave her alone with Roy and an awful husband that she marries and stays with for a while?
I'm not exactly sure. It might have been that I was I caught on at some point that I was doing some twinning in the structure of the novel as well, and that different sections of the novel sort of mirror another section. So in the first section, right at the start, Edie is left alone with Roy. And Dean has facilitated that, not anything conscious. He fell ill and wasn't able to make the journey with Dean that was expected. Hmm. So maybe it just seemed like a nice way to carry on something in the next section. So now, once again, she's going to be alone with Roy because Dean is ill. You said early on that Roy, in his awful way sometimes, loves Edie. And I believe that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that Edie has some feelings for Roy as well. But they're not the kinds of feelings that he has for her. And they just cannot communicate that to each other. They come a little closer, I think. They come closer as the novel goes on.
Yeah, he does ask her again, you know, if they should run away together, and that whole issue of running away, where are you going to run to, and what do you mean? And they end up going to Bismarck, where you come from originally, and you use land and landscape and, you know, the massive distances that we have out here in the west part of the United States. And it's almost like those distances are somehow a metaphor for the distance between Edie and Roy. They seem like they're so far apart and can never come together.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Okay. Yeah.
So, what about the places that you produce? Are they important to you in the book, or are you just places that are convenient?
A little bit of both. I mean, I'm sort of working territory that I've covered before, and I feel as though I know the terrain and I know something about the kinds of communities and the kinds of people who live in those communities in that part of the world. So I feel as though I can write about them with some believability, some authenticity.
Yeah. Certainly the
language. It is a part of the world that people have left also. I mean, there are so many communities in prairie communities that have emptied out over the years.
Oh my God! Yeah, absolutely.
The Bismarcks and the Fargos and some of the population, so-called population centers, have done pretty well, but the small towns have often suffered.
Yeah, I'm headed up to Headinger in a couple of weeks, which is literally dying. And then outside of Headinger, you probably know that whole area. Places are just completely emptying out, and Bursaris, and there's just nobody there anymore. It's a ghost town. And you know, it's there's something about your work, and also Hanif and other folks that write about the area, that haunts me. And not, you know, being a city boy from London, it's such a contrast for me to go out there and see these massive open spaces. And you do a great job of hauling all that together. It's just really quite amazing. I've only got about a minute left here. Tell us a little bit about how Let Him Go is going as a film. I think you were on the show with that when it was a novel before it was taken into a film. How's that affected your writing? Has it affected anything in your life having that done, having that filmed?
They did pay me. I don't know that it's made a tremendous difference. I don't think I write any differently. I was very fortunate that somebody with talent and vision pulled that book off the shelf and read it and said, "Oh, I think I could make a movie from this." And that was Tom Bazooka, who wrote the screenplay and directed the film. So I was really lucky. But beyond that, you know what? I like movies. I like good movies, and so I enjoyed watching that. I thought it was a good movie. I by the time it appeared on the screen, I didn't have any sort of proprietary interest anymore. I did my thing, which was to write a book, and then Tom Bazooka did his thing, which was to make a movie.
Well, I don't think you were lucky. I think you made your own luck there, and I think this would make a good movie too. And really. Well done with all of this. I'm watching your career, and it's just blossoming, and you're doing such a fabulous job. You're a great human with what you've done with this job. This is a book that every man should read. Women too, but every man should read this. You know.
I'm just so thank you very much for that. There are a lot of different ways that this book has been talked about, but nobody has ever addressed it in that way. And yes, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Good. Well, appreciate your work. Keep it coming. Can't wait to have the next one. All right.
I'll do my best.
All right. Great to see you again, Larry. And we'll talk soon. Thanks for being back on Ride on Radio.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
And now this.
It's time again for the KFAI Answer Man. We want to make your life just a little bit happier. And we never charge a fee. A listener writes,
"Dear KFAI Answer Man, between the pandemic, climate change, the economy, social issues, and my cat, the world seems to be falling apart. Answer Man, you always seem so calm and rational. How do you do it?" Signed, Running Around Screaming with Hands in the Air.
Dear Running, it's important to take care of yourself in times of stress. After all, you can't help anyone else if you can't function yourself. I recommend getting plenty of rest, drink plenty of water, eat a balanced diet, exercise regularly, and listen to KFAI. KFAI helps relieve stress by helping you keep positive perspectives on your community and the world around us. And your cat will like it too. Does this help? I do hope it makes you feel better. If you have a question for the KFAI Answer Man, just send a postcard to me, your radio friend, at KFAI Minneapolis. For now, goodbye.
Today I'm talking with Caleb Scharf. He's a renowned astrobiologist and the award-winning author for known works like The Zoomable Universe and The Copernicus Complex. Scharf takes our understanding of the universe and human trajectory to the next level with his new book, The Ascent of Information: Books, Bits, Genes, Machines, and Life's Unending Algorithm. Welcome to Right on Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So just for our audience, to get an idea of what this is about, this work is focused on the peculiar nature of humans generating information, not just in the form of books or electronic media, but through means like language and even how physical environments operate as a function of an extended mind. I was curious, though, was it really your trip to Shakespeare's grave that acted as a catalyst for thinking about the variety of forms information takes?
In retrospect, it was. At the time, I didn't quite make the connection, but I do remember I went with my family. We spent a day in Stratford-upon-Avon in England, birthplace of Shakespeare. And just by the end of the day, just thinking, wow, everything we did today is because this person wrote some things, and that information, that those books and plays have persisted through time. So our whole day, our behavior and actions were sort of dictated by that. Isn't that kind of strange? And then later I came back to that when I started thinking about these ideas of all of the information that we generate as a species, and realizing, okay, that's a good example of one particular element of this larger thing.
You conceive a new word, as far as I know, in the book, and I think I'm going to say this right. Is it data-ome?
Yes, that's right. The data-ome.
Would this be the proper definition of the word? The total sum of information we carry inside and outside ourselves as a human race.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much it. It's the information that we generate. Some of it is built into the world around us, in our books, in our language, in our electronic devices. But yeah, some of it is also temporarily held in the electrochemical signals in our brain. But none of it is encoded in our DNA. None of it can be inherited. I can't pass on my genes for, Shakespeare's plays to someone else. But it persists through time with us nonetheless. So it's this sort of externalized informational thing, the data-ome, that coexists with us.
So you mentioned books. I work in publishing, and there's a great line that I think summarizes very well how much I love the bookmaking process. It's the architecture of a book is a manifestation of an idea. But also made me wonder, are there limitations to the data-ome to conceptualize all information or the manifestation of an idea?
That's a really good question. Yeah, so, what's so interesting about this, if you look at the world through this lens, is you start to think, well, everything has an informational basis. So you mentioned the structure of a book. So what is a book? It's, a paper book. It has this cover. It has these pages. They're shaped a certain way. They're rectangular. They're bound together and so on. And they're all in service of presenting these symbols to your human eyes for you to interpret. But in that sense, there is information describing the nature of a book. And so the book itself is informational in its fundamental structure. And so you look around the world, I find myself doing this increasingly after having written the book, and I'll pick up a pencil and I'll think, oh, wow. So someone had to design a pencil. Somewhere there's probably written instructions for, the factory to make the pencils. Everything ultimately seems to be informational in nature, which other people have thought about, but until you really think about it yourself, you tend to ignore.
Let's talk about a little bit of this process here of like making a book, for example. Words on physical paper are still the primary means we feed our global appetite for written material. Books you write are surprisingly demanding little things. I was wondering if you could talk about that, the demands of the kind of energy that it takes to produce a book still today.
Yeah, so one of the kind of deep scientific dives I take in my book is to just understand what's necessary to create the data-ome and all of this information around us. And books are interesting. So books, they're physical. So we have to make paper. And manufacturing paper is pretty energetically demanding. So a single sheet of reasonable quality paper energetically the burden on us as a species. It's roughly equivalent to combusting 5 grams of high quality coal. And, you know, and then you also have to think about, well, growing the trees in the first place and nurturing those trees. And then you have to think about the inks that are used to generate the letters on, I'm sorry, did you hear a ping there? That was my machine.
I heard, I could probably edit out though. So you're okay. Keep going, please.
You know, so the physical production of books is a big energetic burden on our species. And we make a lot of books. I think in the US alone, there's something like 600 million to 700 million books printed every year. And but the interesting thing is the burden doesn't just stop there. You might think that once you have a book in your hands, well, it's not placing any further burden on the world, right? It's kind of this inert thing. But think about your interaction with a book. You have to pick it up. Right. Well, that act of picking up a book, moving something, maybe a meter or so through the air, takes energy. It's energy from your muscles, but you have to metabolize to generate that energy and so on. So, you know, one of the little exercises I do in the book is actually to ask, you know, how much energy have human arms expended in the reading of Shakespeare's plays across the last 400 years. And, you know, you can kind of approximate this, and it turns out to be the equivalent of combusting perhaps hundreds of thousands of tons of coal just to pick up a book, put it on the shelf, take it down from the shelf, open it, and so on. And then you've got the neurons firing, and that's using energy, and so on and so on. So the more you look at it, the more sort of overwhelming the sort of burden of information becomes.
And for large repositories of information, it also requires incredible amounts of energy to maintain and curate that information. I was wondering if you could talk about the energetic burden of trying to do that kind of work.
Yeah, well, so books, physical books, of course, have an energetic burden. But more than that, today is information held electronically. And not only is the quantity of information growing exponentially, there is an increasing energy burden to support it. So the amount of data that we produce every day now is every single day we produce more new data, more new information than the equivalent of every word ever spoken by every human being who ever lived, which is pretty astonishing. And that takes resources. You have to build machines to hold that data, your flash drives, your hard drives, your cloud servers, and so on. And if you look at the figures on this and you look at the energy burden of that, some projections suggest that by 2040, so less than 20 years' time from today, the electricity requirements for supporting all of our cloud servers and our smartphones and all of that stuff will exceed the total amount of electrical power that we generate as a global species today for everything. Now, we can try to be more and more efficient, and people are aware of this issue. People who work in computer science and data are aware of this issue. So we try to make more efficient processes, try to make more efficient data serving systems and structures. But it seems that every time we do that, the amount of data we're interested in expands again, right? There is exponential growth in the amount of data and information we're trying to support. So it's not clear that we're going to dodge that particular bullet. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen. We may find a way to become sufficiently efficient, or we may find a way to start rationing our information in the sense that so much information today arguably has very little utility. You know, and it gets stored, and it gets, you know, it's part of the burden. So all the pictures of, you know, our favorite pets or what we had for lunch, that's an informational burden that has to be implemented somewhere. It's not, you know, for us, it's just sort of ethereal, but it actually has to be built into the world, and that takes energy. So maybe we're going to have to be better about, you know, not keeping everything all the time, but also kind of, you know, what we do to add to this informational burden. But it is pretty shocking.
I was going to ask you this later in the interview, but I think this is a good time to ask about it now. There's an article I came across a few weeks ago. It was from it's a speculation from a Portsmouth physicist, Melvin Vopson. He believes digital information will account for half of Earth's mass, making its growth impossible to sustain by the year 2500. He believes that we should define information as a new form of matter. I was curious to know your thoughts about this.
Yes, I'm a little bit familiar with that work. It's a really interesting point that is made that, yeah, so the information that lives in the world, you know, you can consider it to have mass because it is a restructuring of matter. Mm-hmm. Every time a bit is flipped, you're restructuring matter somehow. And so you can look at that as a mass. And yes, the projection is that that mass will be growing, become comparable to the entire mass of the biosphere. I think for me, you know, information, it's already there in physics and computer science. People have been talking about information for a long time because it's deeply connected to an area of physics called thermodynamics and to do with stuff like entropy, which we use the word entropy when often we're talking about disorder in the world. And it turns out that entropy and information are intimately related. Whether or not think of information in terms of the mass it represents is quite the right thing to do, I'm not sure. But I definitely do believe that information is a quality of the natural world. It's a quality of the universe. It's not exclusive to us. I mean, biological organisms are based on information. Genes are informational in nature. And so it's something we probably should bring into our dictionary of physics, our dictionary for describing the world, much like we use energy and entropy and speed and mass. These are all qualities of the world. Information is another quality of the world that we probably ought to be thinking about a little bit more.
So I think this is a good time to ask you then, several thinkers have raised this question of whether information itself is the fundamental currency of the universe. I was wondering if you explain a little the basis for this reasoning.
Yeah, so this actually goes to some pretty deep fundamental physics and our understanding of the nature of reality. And it goes to quantum mechanics, in fact. And quantum mechanics describes the way the world works at very small scales, in particular at the scale of atoms and molecules. And as many people will have heard, your quantum physics tells us that the fundamental nature of reality is weird. It's kind of fuzzy and uncertain, and things like particles aren't really particles until we observe them, until we interact with them or something interacts with them. They exist in a sort of superposition of fuzzy probabilities. Maybe something is over there, maybe it's over there. It's not until you look that it kind of snaps to attention and you localize it. And in that sense, people have long speculated that information is a part of that process. When you interact with something and it suddenly is no longer a fuzzy probabilistic thing, it snaps to attention as a particle or as an atom or molecule. That's kind of like an informational process. It's asking a question of the world, where are you? And there's an answer that comes back. And so that suggests that information may be the thing beneath everything we see, that everything ultimately comes down to a series of yes, no questions or one or zero questions, which is really mind-blowing and fascinating.
I have my notes here, which I really like. There's a phrase you have in the book saying that our universe is a participatory universe.
Yeah, so this is an idea that actually goes back to a very famous physicist, John Wheeler, who also coined the term black hole, incidentally, or helped coin that term. Yeah, he used this terminology of a participatory universe, that in the end, you know, his idea was, again, based in quantum physics, that, you know, arguably nothing really matters or exists until it's interacted with, until it's observed, until there's an exchange of information. And he also has a beautiful example of how a way to think about this. It's actually a really nice game you can play with friends. So we've heard of 20 questions, the game. Well, he has this description of a thing called negative 20 questions, where nobody has really decided on what the answer is, but every time a question is asked, a yes, no question, you know, is it a human? Does it have legs? You know, is it this color? And the response comes back. Anyone who answers has to answer in a way that is consistent with all previous answers. But nobody has, as a whole, agreed on what the answer is. So if you play that game, the remarkable thing is eventually you'll converge on some answer. You'll converge on, oh, it was a puppy, or it was a cup of coffee. And nobody had fully agreed ahead of time on what that would be. But if every answer to every question is consistent with the previous ones, you'll eventually converge. So that's kind of an example of how something sort of snaps into being, even though there wasn't an answer there at the outset. It was a series of participatory decisions that led you to that answer, which is also kind of mind-blowing.
Which demonstrates that reality almost builds itself based off the information it kind of generates within itself.
Exactly. It's the interaction between things, whatever those are, that give those things their quality. Because if they are not interacting, then it's meaningless to talk about the quality of anything.
Let's take a step back here. There's a subject I thought was really interesting that you touch on in the book. I was wondering if you could talk about the potential energy demands that are going to come with cryptocurrencies as become more commonplace. And
yeah, I mean, this is obviously high on people's minds. And in the news recently, Elon Musk has even stated that, you know, Tesla, which has a certain amount of Bitcoin, won't utilize that until Bitcoin servers become more energy efficient, until they become, you know, carbon neutral. So cryptocurrency is one example of a really extraordinary evolutionary development in our external information, in our data ohm, that is incredibly energy intensive. So cryptocurrency rests on this technique called the blockchain, which is a little complicated to explain, but it's essentially a way of making it very, very hard to subvert data. It's very hard to change stuff. It's to do with cryptography, so stuff can be encrypted, but it's more about making it almost impossible to alter stuff, to fake things, right? So in currency, it'd be great if I could forge currency. Well, cryptocurrency is incredibly difficult to forge because it would require almost an infinite amount of computing time and effort to forge the currency. But to construct the currency in the first place, and the currency is in the form of these complex algorithmic bundles of data, if you will, to construct those bundles of data that are very immune to being forged or altered takes a huge amount of computing energy and time. So much so that right now, by some estimates, a currency like Bitcoin is actually already using up as much electrical power as the entire nation of Ireland generates. And it's because people want that currency. And one way you can get some of the currency is by doing what's called mining. And mining is essentially solving a series of cryptographic puzzles in order to generate new currency, to build those sort of very resilient data packages. It's a lot of sort of computational chugging to do that. And that's why people are investing in it. But it means that it's one reason it's hard to buy certain kinds of microprocessors these days, graphic processing units, because they're being bought up by people who are generating cryptocurrency in order to get rich off of it. Right. And that's a really extraordinary development. And it's so energy demanding that, in a sense, we have to hope that cryptocurrency doesn't grow further. Because if cryptocurrency became the sole currency of our species, that could be very problematic in terms of the energy resources that would have to be devoted to it.
I'm gonna ask you this question now because I want to make sure we have enough time for you to respond to this. I never was aware of this before reading your book. I want you to discuss this study this field of study called artificial life or A-life. What is it? What was your involvement? You went to, I think, Tokyo for a grouping of people to discuss this. Please explain it to me.
Yeah, not so many people have heard about artificial life. So this is a field, it's been shortened to A-life, that really started up. I mean, arguably it started a long time ago when people started asking whether they could build simulacra of living things. And, you know, can you build a mechanical animal that essentially behaves in the way as a real animal does. And then that developed over time into really the 1980s and 1990s, where people started using computers to see if they could generate in software essentially digital organisms. So living systems, but built in software, because we can look at the world and say, well, we sort of think we understand how cells work and we understand how genes work and inheritance. So can we build little software entities that have the equivalent of genes and that can reproduce and can see natural selection taking place, can actually undergo Darwinian evolution? And that was the field of, or is the field of artificial life. The it's placed on the question of, can we construct things in the world that are entirely equivalent to biological life? And it's a really interesting field. It has attracted some fantastic thinkers and some kind of strange and interesting people to it, because it's kind of out there. The remarkable thing is, though, some of the work in A-life, artificial life, over the years has actually ended up helping build our present world of machine learning and AI. Some of these ideas about, you know, artificial neural networks in software come out of thinking in A-life. And A-life continues as a field, but it, you know, it hasn't yet succeeded. And that's one of the big puzzles, but also one of the fascinating things about it. It turned out, after initial enthusiasm, it wasn't easy to do this, right? You know, life didn't suddenly spring up in your computer program. You got things that were very interesting, and entities that would do things like swarm, like birds swarm, or undergo a kind of genetic evolution. But nobody was ever able to produce something that took off in the way that life on Earth has taken off. And so it's a very cool and interesting field. I've been involved in it so peripherally through various projects in astrobiology, which is my field of study. And astrobiology is about looking for life in the universe, but also understanding what life is.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guests tonight, Caleb Scharf and Larry Watson, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned. Well, bonjour, Minnesota.